Hey everyone, and welcome back to your Linux and open source weekly news show. I'm your host, Nick, and this is a podcast where we discuss everything that happened in the Linux, open source, privacy, and open web space during the past week. And in this episode, we have Linux passing 4% market share on the desktop, proving that this progression is not a fluke. We have Fedora willing to drop the X11 session out of the default install in their GNOME variant. We've got a lot about the EU's Digital Markets Act, where Apple is making a mess of their compliance, terminating some developer accounts, getting a giant fine for some barriers they erected in the App Store, and a lot of other nefarious things. We've got GTK fixing font rendering, GNOME 46 getting variable refresh rate, the Yuzu developers catering to Nintendo's demands and shutting down the project, and a lot more. So as always, if you want to dive deeper into any of these topics, all the links that I use to make this show are in the show notes. And if you want to support the show, there are links in the description as well. And if you become a Patreon member or a YouTube member, starting at $1 a month, you will get a daily version of this show from Monday to Friday for even more pinpoint daily news. So now let's get started with the podcast. So first, Linux has now passed 4% market share on the desktop, according to StatCounter. It's actually at 4.03%. And yeah, StatCounter might not be like the end-all be-all of data, because it's just an aggregation website that just grabs analytics data from a bunch of internet sites and just tries to deduce things. So it's not necessarily representative of the whole world, of every single user or user type, but it is interesting to monitor the progression of market share on various desktops. Now, 4% still obviously cannot hold a candle to things like Windows or even macOS, although the latter, macOS, seems to be losing market share since the end of 2023, again, if StatCounter can be trusted. Now, if we add Chrome OS's market share to Linux, because this is a normal thing to do, Chrome OS is basically now a Linux distro with their own proprietary desktop on top of it. And this would put Linux as a whole at 6.3% of the desktop operating system's share. It might be more, because StatCounter also has an unknown OS category that sits at 6.1%. This probably contains some amount of Linux-based operating systems as well that just either change their user agent or hide which system they're using. It's much more likely that a Linux user would do that than a Windows or macOS user. They're generally more tech-savvy, so they generally are more aware of how you could do this. So it's probably higher than 6%, but confirmed at least it's 6.3%, including Chrome OS and Linux distros. It is still very small, but it is a nice progression, more than 1% in 8 months, which is way bigger as a growth than we've ever seen on Linux. So it's an encouraging trend. It looked like it might just have been a temporary thing for the end of year holidays, but this upward trend continued in January and February, so it seems to confirm that it's not just a fluke. Now, people were wondering what is driving this growth, and there's one article from ZDNet that advances a few plausible reasons. The first one is that Microsoft is not as interested in Windows as it once were. Most of Microsoft's profits do not come from the sales of Windows these days. It's still a major profit generator because they sell licenses to OEMs, to computer manufacturers, but these days, Azure, their cloud platform, Microsoft 365, and others are the main money makers, meaning that Windows is not, Microsoft is not pushing Windows as hard as it once did. Now, obviously, this might change in the future if, or more likely when, Windows becomes a subscription service. Now, the second reason they're advancing is that Linux gaming is also growing, thanks to Valve and the Steam Deck. So more people are interested in trying Linux in a regular computer, because once you've seen that you can play the games that you like on a handheld running Linux, you start to think that maybe you can do the same on your regular desktop gaming PC, which is far more powerful than your Steam Deck. And for some people, Linux will stick and will replace Windows. Third, the reputation Linux has for being difficult is slowly being adjusted, because we have very user-friendly distros, we've had them for a while, and people are finally realizing it. There's also the fact that finding and installing software for Linux is easier than ever. More apps are working on Linux nowadays, and Flatpaks and Snaps give you a one-stop shop repo for all your applications, and they're all up to date, compared to a distro's repo where you would have to wait 6 months to get a feature update to most applications, and you also don't have to add third-party repos for each and every app you like, so they're definitely an improvement for a lot of users. And finally, ZDNet says that India is a huge driver for Linux growth, as Linux represents 15% of the desktop market share there, way above something like macOS that only reaches 3%. Now, these are all interesting potential reasons. I think the ones that I find most likely are, first, the gaming push from Valve. When people realize that, yes, you can game on Linux and virtually every game will run, unless it uses some weird anti-cheat. If you're mostly a single-player gamer, you can game on Linux and you don't really need Windows anymore. And once you realize that this works on a Steam Deck or on another handheld, then you do realize that your main PC could also run Linux, and then you start using it for the other tasks that you have. And this compounds with the fact that Linux is easier than ever to use, with more access to apps, easier to install, easier to just handle in day-to-day tasks, with better support for various configurations and hardware, which means that once you've discovered that Linux can work for you, you're more likely to stick with it than you were before. So all in all, it's very encouraging to see this growth for Linux on the desktop. We'll have to see in the coming months if it keeps up and if the market share keeps growing. But for now, yeah, 4% is not a bad place to be, especially if you count that in terms of pure numbers. That's probably a few hundred million users using Linux on a desktop computer, which is not a small market to address for any company that would want to distribute software. Next, we need to talk about Fedora, and they will very likely be dropping the X11 session for GNOME, starting with Fedora 41. There were discussions to drop X11 in the KDE variant, and that's obviously going to happen for Fedora 40. They will not ship the X11 session, and it will be in an external repo if you want to reinstall it. But for the main GNOME version of Fedora, the discussion was also started, but didn't reach a decision yet. In the end, this will happen with Fedora 41, not Fedora 40. So in October, the GNOME X11 session will no longer be installed by default when you use the ISO for Fedora. Only the Wayland session will be offered to users, since it has been the default session for a long while. Now, on Fedora GNOME, you still will be able to install that X11 session from the repos. It is not completely removed, but it won't be offered in the default install, which I think is a good thing. It will take up less disk space, it will remove some disk usage in the ISO itself, and even though it's not insanely heavy, it still will save a bit of space. It will also make more people give a real shot to Wayland, instead of dismissing it out of hand based on preconceived notions that they might have built 5 years ago. And for people who still experience big problems under Wayland, because this will happen, there are some older NVIDIA GPUs out there that just don't work well with Wayland. There are some applications that haven't made the move to support Wayland either. So those people will still be able to install the older X11 session and have a fully functioning system. Fedora has always been the test bed for mature technologies in the Linux desktop. And Wayland these days is in a really, really good state, even on GNOME, especially if you add the X-Wayland video bridge, so you can fix the remaining screen sharing issues on applications that just did not update their Electron base to support Wayland, stuff like Discord, for example. And with Wine on Wayland being close to ready as well, I think October is not a bad timeline to make that switch finally happen. Now we need to talk about the European Digital Markets Act, because this law went into full effect in March, and Apple and other companies, but mainly Apple, are really trying to avoid complying with it correctly. So first, there were a bunch of companies. After Apple announced their various changes to their App Store policies, their fees, a lot of developers were just not happy about those. And they bunched up together and wrote an open letter to the European Commission. These include Spotify, Deezer, Proton, Epic Games, and a lot of other companies, plus a bunch of associations mainly related to newspapers and media, but not just that. So all of them are arguing that the terms Apple offers to avoid using their App Store are voluntarily worse than the ones you would get by using the official App Store, with additional fees that make it very hard to read how much you're gonna pay and potentially makes it even more expensive to not use Apple's App Store, which obviously doesn't conform to the spirit of the Digital Markets Act. They're also saying that Apple plans to implement scare screens to deter consumers from actually benefiting from this new regulation, to try and make it seem that only the official App Store is secure and that everything else will just steal their data or whatever, which of course is not a blanket statement that you could make. For example, on Android, you've got the F-Droid store. It's not full of malicious apps, so it's not true, and making those statements only serves Apple's goals to make users stick to the Apple App Store, where they make their money. Now, all of these companies also say that Apple doesn't allow pure sideloading, just taking an application and sideloading it without barriers or profiles or certificates, and that they're actually erecting new barriers by using the Digital Markets Act as a scapegoat. I personally do not disagree with these companies. What Apple is offering here is either you keep things how they are with enormous commissions and no control over your app, or you're gonna pay potentially more to use less of Apple's services. And all the dark patterns Apple is known for will also definitely scare users into never using anything outside of their store. We also cannot ignore the fact that it's big companies arguing to get more profit instead of passing that profit on to Apple. They might say that they're here to fight for the consumer, but the real issue is that they want to gain more money. In the end, though, if the Digital Markets Act is enforced correctly, the consumer will benefit. These companies will benefit as well, but the consumer will benefit also. And along those lines, again, Apple decided to completely shut down Epic Games' developer account in the EU. The company tried to open a new developer account in the EU to work on their third-party store, where they would presumably sell all of their own games and make more money off of in-app purchases. But Apple almost immediately terminated that account, arguing that Epic Games just cannot be trusted to respect Apple's policies, and that Epic publicly criticized Apple's DMA compliance, which apparently is a major offense for Apple and means that they just don't want Epic Games here anymore. So obviously, Epic Games is furious. It basically prevents them from developing their third-party app store, which obviously is something Apple doesn't want to see at all, because Epic Games like Fortnite make a lot of money for Apple. Apple even denied Epic a DMA consultation, which is basically a meeting where they can discuss how best to implement the things that the new EU regulation grants companies that want to distribute apps on Apple's platforms. So yeah, the masks are off. Apple just does not want big developers to escape their own app store. They will find any reason they can to keep their 30% commission active. I don't like Epic as a company. They have a horrible track record when it comes to respecting consumers or even other developers that use the Unreal Engine. But there is no valid reason here to prevent them to access the rights granted to them in the EU. And so right after Epic complained about Apple terminating this account, the EU said that they were going to look into the matter immediately. So they have requested further explanations from Apple on the matter, and they're evaluating whether Apple's actions raise doubts about their compliance, not only to the Digital Markets Act, but also with other European laws, especially the Platform to Business regulations. That's a set of law that came into being in 2020, and they're here to prevent sudden and unexpected account terminations in the EU, unless you can provide clear and valid reasons for that termination. Which, apparently, Apple really hasn't done here. They cited a US court ruling as the justification for terminating the account, which is obviously not gonna work here because the account they terminated was for the EU branch of Epic, and it concerns their activities in the EU, where US courts just do not have any jurisdiction. So this is a giant mess. Apple is dragging their feet. They do not want to comply with these rules. They do not want to let developers get away from the App Store and make more money. They want to keep that hefty commission. They want to keep those profits, and they want to keep control over what they allow on their platform. They might spend that as a security concern, but the real concern for them is making more money. And they also cannot catch a break in the EU at all, because the European Commission deemed their policies anti-competitive on another topic. The policies in question are related to how Apple prevents app developers from telling users about cheaper options to subscribe to their service, notably for music streaming services, since it is Spotify who brought the case before the EU. So Apple obviously takes 30% commission on in-app subscriptions, which means that developers tend to increase their prices on iOS by the same amount to avoid taking too much loss on these prices. But Apple prevents these developers from telling their users that they could subscribe for cheaper on the web. They don't have the right to include a link to their own website where people could buy these cheaper subscriptions, and they can't even send an email to a customer that subscribed on iOS to tell them that they could subscribe for cheaper later. So the European Commission ruled that this is unfair trading. These provisions are not necessary, they're not proportionate to the protection of Apple's business, and they negatively affect iOS users by preventing them from making an informed decision on how to subscribe to various services. It made iOS users pay higher prices than other consumers, and it forced them into annoying searches to try and find the cheaper options themselves. So Apple will have to pay 1.8 billion euros in fines for abusing their dominant position. And more importantly, they will have to remove all these barriers from the App Store, meaning that app developers will now be able to talk about various pricing options in their apps. They will be able to link users to their own website to subscribe if they don't want to pay more for the same thing. And this is wonderful news. It breaks down Apple's grip over iOS a bit more. It means cheaper prices for every iOS user. And as far as I understand it, it doesn't just affect music streaming services. It also affects every other app in the store. So it's a big win for European consumers. So all in all, to recap, Apple doesn't want to conform with European laws, but they are getting battered left and right by the European Commission, and there's no doubt in my mind that they will have to just stop their unfair practices that they're trying to implement here. They already had to back down on progressive web apps. They will probably also have to back down on shuttering developer accounts and on trying to make developers pay extra fees if they don't use Apple services. Okay, now that this open web, open tech segment is over, let's go back to Linux and open source. So first, GTK 4.14 is going to be an interesting update. It will fix a long-standing issue on Linux, which is font rendering. The new release focuses on making sure that fonts can look crisper, less pixelated, and less blurry in GTK apps and in GNOME, especially when using fractional scaling. Now, this is all due to the new renderers that GTK recently added, and now the toolkit can now optimize either for uniform font spacing or for crisp rendering when you need to scale the font. This means that rendering text with fractional scaling on will look less blurry and will be better aligned, especially since the new renderers actually render the text at the fractional scaling factor that you picked. The old renderers rendered the text at 200%, and then the compositor scaled that back to your desired factor, so for example 125%, which meant that the text was scaled twice and obviously didn't look right. Letters with these new renderers and in GTK 4.14 will now look much more consistent as well. Before, when you looked at two instances of the same letter on the same line, those letters didn't really have the same thickness, they weren't consistently placed vertically. And judging from the screenshots the GTK developers pushed, it is going to make a big difference in how text looks in GNOME and GTK apps when you're scaling your display. It is very cool to have that thing finally fixed. It's been a major complaint of a lot of Linux users for a while. And still on GNOME, It looks like GNOME 46 is going to include variable refresh rate after all. It previously looked like this had missed the deadline and wouldn't make it in time for GNOME 46, but it has now been merged in the release candidate of the latest version of GNOME, meaning that you will get at least an experimental option to try things out if you have an adaptive sync or a FreeSync compatible display. And on top of that, the compositor in GNOME 46 will also bring a few interesting fixes. Notably, they're gonna fix drag and drop issues on Wayland by unifying how the pointer and the keyboard grabbing system is handled. They will let you dismiss pop-ups by clicking outside of apps on touchscreens. They will also fix a sync issue in X11, and fractional scaling in general will be better handled in GNOME 46. So it is nice to see that people will not have to wait 6 extra months to start using variable refresh rate on GNOME. It will be experimental, of course, so probably there's gonna be some issues. You will have to enable it manually using something like dconf, but it is good to have it in the hands of users sooner so it can be well tested and it can be fully baked for GNOME 47. Now we're gonna talk about open source project and especially the Yuzu emulator. It looks like, unfortunately, Nintendo's pressure was too much for the Yuzu team. They agreed to settle with Nintendo and to pay $2.4 million in damages to the company, and they will also shut down the Yuzu project entirely, and also the Citra emulator for Nintendo DS and 3DS, because it was made by the same team. So they will stop distributing, advertising, and promoting Yuzu, and its source code will no longer be public. Actually, the GitHub repos are already closed. They also have turned their websites over to Nintendo, and they are instructed to delete any tool used for Yuzu's development. And funnily enough, Nintendo also asked them to remove every copy of Yuzu that exists anywhere, which is obviously not something you can do because no developer can control what people have installed on their computers. Same with the source code, it probably got forked like crazy after Nintendo initially sued the makers of Yuzu to ensure that the project can live on, so obviously it is going to be available. It's probably already somewhere in a GitHub repo or GitLab repo. And like I said, the Citra emulator also got caught in the crossfire. It was developed by the same people, so it will cease to exist as well. And I am 99% sure that someone will start publishing the source code under a different name and relatively stealthily. But of course, as soon as Nintendo gets wind of these rebooted projects, they will receive the same kind of attention. Nintendo is and always has been a terrible company when it comes to this stuff. They are overprotective of everything that they do. They will send cease and desist for everything, including fan art, fan games, or whatever. Now, at least this wasn't a ruling from a court. It was settled outside of courts, so future emulators don't face a legal blanket statement that would say all emulation is illegal, so other emulators might get the chance to fight in court if they want to. It is still very sad to see this project go. No one will be able to convince me that this generated many losses for Nintendo in terms of revenue. They are doing really well. It's just threatening open source projects to gain a few pennies. I don't think it's really in their best interest to do that. It just destroys their image even further, which wasn't very good to begin with. Now, still on litigation, but this time with a positive result. This is something I missed last month, but a French court has issued damages for a GPL violation, something that is rare enough in the world in general to be mentioned, because a lot of companies just grab open source code, include it in their proprietary projects without anyone knowing, and they just use it, never just share any sort of source code or modification that they've done. So it is rare that a company is actually caught using something and being fined and just basically condemned by a court to pay damages for mishandling GPL code. So in this case, it's Orange. It's a big telecom provider in France. And apparently they used GPL software called Lasso to enable single sign-on in a portal developed for the French government that lets people handle their public services. But apparently Orange did not pass on any of their changes to the community, they didn't make their source code available, and they didn't let any of the users of the portal download that source code. So they were sued by the makers of the Lasso library. Their case was rejected at first, but was then overturned in the appeals court, thus cementing that breaching the GPL is not only a violation of contract, because Orange just basically agreed to the terms of the license, which is a contract, when they decided to use this library, but it's also copyright infringement because they did not respect the terms of copyright for the Lasso library. At least this is stated in France. Other countries might decide otherwise, but in France it is now a solid precedent that companies can use to defend their open source code. So Orange will have to pay 500,000 euros in compensatory damages and 150,000 euros in moral damages as well, which is not much for Orange as a company, but it is still a big win for open source and free software licenses. And it might also make other developers want to take a look at how their free and open source code is being used and redistributed, because, as I said, it sets a precedent in France against abusing these licenses. So it's a nice win for a change for open source and the GPL. Now, something interesting on the Microsoft side, but that might also affect Linux in the long run. Windows 11 has had a subsystem for Android almost since Windows 11 was released. It let people download a subsystem to run Android apps, and then download and run Android apps from the Amazon App Store straight from the Windows Store. And this is going to end soon. Microsoft announced that they will be winding down support for that subsystem, since it didn't see much success or adoption. People still have a full year to use it. I think it's gonna end in early March 2025, but after that date, it's gone and you won't be able to run Android apps on Windows anymore. So you might wonder, why am I talking about this here? Well, it's because every time I talk about Linux, there's someone mentioning somewhere that if only Linux could run Android apps by default, Linux would gain so much market share and would just outgrow Windows, and it would be a great idea, it would give people more options. And while that is true for a few applications, the problems with this kind of implementation of Android apps inside of another OS make it interesting to very few people. You generally cannot ship that implementation with Google services or the Play Store, so you will always be limited to a few applications and not the whole roster. Although, I guess you could use the Aurora Store and a free and open source implementation of the Play services, but this comes with issues, some apps don't run, you also have the Google Safety Net that isn't passed in generally any of those emulators, and also, it is emulation, it's ARM emulation on x86, which obviously has performance impacts. And people generally don't seem to care about running Android apps on a desktop OS, even when the integration is well done, like what Windows offered. It was very easy to install, it was easy to get apps for this, and still no one seemed to care. And it's also true for Apple. On macOS, you can now run iOS apps, but very few developers elected to publish their iOS apps on macOS, and users of these apps just find them not very usable. The interface is not designed for being used on a desktop, they're feature limited, they're just not as good as a real desktop application, and so people will just not use those. And of course, Windows is not Linux. Windows has much more apps developed for it than Linux. So maybe Windows users just didn't see the need to get Android apps because they already had solid desktop apps. Maybe us Linux users would benefit more from it, especially for applications that are proprietary and that don't have a Linux version. But it also looks like, from the Windows 11 thing, that no one thinks it's worth the work. People just don't care, so we probably should not focus on that thing either. I would personally rather we find ways to get desktop apps ported over to Linux than trying to cram Android apps to fill their role. Zorin OS 17.1 was also released this week, and it's a minor version upgrade. I generally don't talk much about those, but it does ship some interesting improvements, especially for people who run Windows apps and games on Linux. because Xorin OS ships with what they call Windows App Integration, which in one click lets you install, Wine and a bunch of desktop integrations to run Windows programs. The issue was that their Wine integration was pretty old, so they've replaced that with Wine 9.0, which brings a lot better compatibility than the Wine 8 that they shipped before, because they only ship stable Wine versions. And also, when you install this Windows compatibility layer that is in their App Center, you will also install Bottles, which is a very cool application that lets you install Wine applications in a, well, Windows applications using Wine in a much better fashion. It comes with DXVK, with a bunch of extra libraries, it creates a unique Wine prefix for each app, and it even has a bunch of pre-install scripts, so you don't really have to do any configuration yourself. It's a much-needed app if you want to run Windows applications on Linux. And also, if a user tries to install a Windows app in Xorin OS by double-clicking a .exe or .msi program, Xorin will actually tell them to install this compatibility layer first in just one click. They even have thumbnails for these types of applications so you can see the icon of the program. They've also introduced the new Xorin Education Edition that comes with a reading strip GNOME Shell extension, which makes on-screen highlighting easier for people who have trouble focusing on a specific line of text or paragraph, and they also have open-source education or learning-focused software pre-installed, like LogSec, LibreCAD, and more. And you might not like using Windows apps on Linux, but it is true that for a lot of beginners, this might be a reflex that they have. They will go onto a website, they will download an EXE or MSI, and they'll try to run it. They might not necessarily know about all the ways you can get programs on Linux. Now, Xorin will apparently also tell them if there's a Linux version of the same program they're trying to install available in the App Store. They will actually tell them, well, you should probably install the Linux version instead of trying to run the Windows one, which is pretty cool. But still, for beginners and new users, the ability to sometimes manage to run a Windows program might be cool. The only issue I have with that is that a lot of programs will just not run or not run well, and so you're giving the illusion that you can support Windows apps all the time where you clearly cannot. Even with Bottles and a lot of pre-configuration being done, some programs just do not run, especially the ones that people really want to run, like the Creative Cloud Suite or Microsoft Office. Now still, Xorin OS is a slowly updated distro, but every time they release something, it's always to make things easier for users. It is one of the most user-friendly distros out there. It's not necessarily what I would recommend for a full beginner because it is based on an Ubuntu LTS, meaning that hardware compatibility can be an issue even with the hardware enablement stack, but it is still a solid proposition nonetheless. Okay, now let's finish this with the gaming news. And first, we have more progress on the FEX emulator to run x86 binaries on ARM devices. And there's a new update that now fixes Steam support. It now makes it possible to run the app again. They also added Mesa 24 drivers to the package, and they better optimized their CPU-related code, all of this bringing 4% better performance overall on Geekbench and up to 14% in an unspecified benchmark, meaning that, yeah, you're gonna be able to run x86 programs on ARM devices running Linux relatively well now, which is a good thing for stuff like Asahi Linux, but also for the future in general, because ARM computers might at some point become the most widely used platform, who knows, and if they come to that, well, at least we'll be ready to run our applications while they get ported. Now, we're going to talk about drivers next, and first, Linux kernel developers decided that it was not a good idea to let people completely undervolt their AMD GPUs on Linux. Currently, you can tweak the AMD GPU driver to supply very, very little power to your GPU to save some battery life, for example. The issue is, this could lead to damages to your hardware because it is completely undervolted, it doesn't perform adequately, and so it can break. So in the kernel 6.7, you will no longer be able to set power limits below the recommended values that AMD provides. Now, you could previously fine-tune that, but this did not match AMD's recommendations, and so these power limits will now be enforced. And the developers clearly stated that they will not reinstate this capability. They don't want people to play around with that. And apparently some people are annoyed by that, but I really don't see why. Because yes, sure, you could completely undervolt your CPU to save your GPU, sorry, to save a bit of battery life, maybe a few minutes, at the potential price of destroying your GPU. Is it worth it? No, in no circumstance is it worth risking damages to your expensive hardware just to tinker and save a few minutes of battery life or a few, like, watts of power. The default behavior of any driver should be to be safe for the hardware. If you absolutely need to bypass that, you're welcome to compile an unpatched kernel or run an older version of the AMD GPU drivers. But the default kernel should absolutely not let people get into a state where their hardware should be damaged. If you know what you're doing, cool. You know how to install another kernel or an older version of the driver or to patch that driver. If you don't know what you're doing, you should never be able to cause damage to your hardware by just using a system. Now, I also talked recently about the issues AMD is facing with adding newer HDMI features to their open source drivers, because the AGMI forum just refuses to open the spec for the HDMI standard, and so these new features for HDMI 2.1 cannot be implemented in an open source driver. Now, apparently, NVIDIA users will not be facing the same issues, even with the nouveau drivers, because a lot of the display handling is left in NVIDIA's firmware blobs, which are closed source and so do not pose problems for the HDMI forums. Nouveau developer says that it looks backwards, but that NVIDIA's insistence to put all the logic in their proprietary firmware is actually helping Nouveau to add support for the latest HDMI features. And NVIDIA's own open source modules apparently also support this feature set for HDMI 2.1 because they rely on the proprietary firmware, so there's every reason to think Nouveau will be able to support those as well. And yeah, we are at that point on Linux where you get more features if the entire stack is not open source, which kinda sucks. The Nouveau drivers and NVK might be open, but they will rely on proprietary firmware to run well and to get access to certain features. So it is not a fully open source stack. It's often what I refer to it as. I often say we're finally going to be able to run fully open source NVIDIA drivers, but it's not entirely true. They're still a proprietary firmware blob compared to AMD, which has no blobs for their open source AMD GPU drivers, but that also prevents them from implementing some features because the HDMI forum is pretty much bullshit. And finally, to conclude on drivers and on this episode, for NVIDIA, it seems like the open source modules that NVIDIA publishes themselves, which are different from the Nouveau drivers or NVK, well, those modules are now performing very nicely on GeForce GPUs. With the latest 550 update, the modules are now certified not only for server workloads, but also for workstations and GeForce general use. So Foronix decided to give them a go compared to the proprietary drivers. They did not compare these open source modules to Nouveau and NVK yet, but I'm pretty sure this will come pretty soon. In CSGO 2, they found the performance to be the exact same between the open source modules from NVIDIA and their proprietary drivers, and power consumption was also virtually identical. The same was found with Dirt Rally 2, with Formula 1 2022, with Hitman 3, Shadow of the Tomb Raider, and a bunch of graphics benchmarks. Even using compute benchmarks, they found that the differences in performance were very minimal. So it looks like NVIDIA's official open source drivers are pretty good indeed. They're not really compatible with the architecture and the coding principles of the Linux kernel, so they will probably not make it into the mainline kernel anytime soon. A developer seems to favor Nouveau and NVK instead, NVK being part of Mesa and Nouveau being part of the Linux kernel, over these open source NVIDIA modules. They just don't really fit with how the kernel is structured right now. But for people who don't want to wait for Nuvo and NVK to be widely available and to match the performance of the proprietary NVIDIA drivers, this doesn't look like a bad option anymore, if you're ready to install and compile these drivers yourself. Though they will probably suffer from the same issues with Wayland as the proprietary drivers. Well, mostly X Wayland. Wayland works really well on NVIDIA nowadays. It's X Wayland that's the problem, because those open source modules are apparently based on the same code as the proprietary drivers, but it is worth a shot. And more interestingly, maybe at some point, NVIDIA will transition their main focus for Linux drivers on the open source modules instead of prioritizing the proprietary modules, meaning that distros, instead of packaging the proprietary drivers, would be able to just package the open source driver and add them as an out-of-tree driver, which is already what they're doing with the proprietary one, but the code being open source, it's probably much more in the ethos and philosophies of a lot of Linux distros. So pretty good improvements all around here, and with Nuvo and NVK on one side and the open source NVIDIA modules on the other, we're in a good place for open source NVIDIA support. Okay, so this will conclude this episode of the show. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, if you want to learn more about any of these topics, all the links are in the show notes. And if you want to support the show to keep it going, there are plenty of links in the show notes as well. And if you become a Patreon member or a YouTube member, you will get a daily version of that show from Monday to Friday. So thanks for listening, and I guess you'll hear me in the next one next week. Bye!